Greetings and welcome to Edgy Ideas, the podcast that explores what it means to live the good life and create the good society in our disruptive age. My name is Simon Western, and I will be talking to invited guests about diverse topics, exploring social conscious and unconscious dynamics and desires. So welcome to this edition of Edgy Ideas Podcast. Today, my special guest is Julian Lusada. Julian is a psychoanalyst. He's the former director of the adult department at the Tavistock and Portman Clinic, former chair of the British Psychoanalytic Council, and chair of the British Psychoanalytic Federation. Julian now practices as an organizational consultant in private practice. Julian, you're very welcome to Edgy Ideas. It's great to have you here. How are you today?
Okay, thank you, Simon.
Good. I was thinking before this podcast that we've known each other probably over 20 years now. We met at the Tavistock Clinic when I was a student on the organizational consulting course. You were my supervisor. So we go back a bit.
Yes, indeed.
I've always been very impressed by your thinking, Julia, and your psychoanalytic take on the world. So that's what we'll explore today. Previous to this this recording, we thought about some of the major issues floating around, and you mentioned the term complacency was one of your thinking spaces at the moment. You're concerned about complacency. Do you want to say a little bit about that?
Sure. Well, I came to think about complacency really as a consequence of ending with a patient who I thought I'd done some very good work with. And indeed, the patient gave me no reason to think otherwise. But when she left, she sent me a card in which there was a little piglet and a little kitten snuggling together. And she said, "Don't they make a lovely couple?" Now, I thought, this is an extraordinary, on the one hand, I enjoyed the sentimentality of it.
Yeah.
And it conveyed something. On the other hand, here are two species that can't create anything. And that really troubled me. And it made me wonder about what I'd missed in the treatment. But what really caught my attention, I mean, there's probably a lot I could say about the clinical work, but not for here, was that I presented this patient on a number of occasions to my CPD group, professional group.
Yeah.
Who were usually very rigorous. But with this patient, they sort of went along with that everything was going fine. And so what struck me was that one of the core characteristics of complacency is the way that it recruits others to a sort of shallow project. And that's what alerted me and has sort of been of interest to me ever since, that, you know, complacency is so often thought of as rather benign, you know, somebody's slightly gone off piste or whatever. But I think it's a rather malignant a state of mind. And it's, if I think about the patient, clearly there was an area that I had avoided. Maybe she had too, but I had, you know, not gotten to grips with. But, you know, if complacency misrepresents reality in some way, that there was some part of this treatment, if one thinks about how this can get the grip in an organization. And so that's really where it's led me, my interest in. It's led me to a thinking about, you know, is there something about being a psychotherapist or even a consultant that leads one into a slightly passive position in the face of, you know, the drama and distress of the contemporary world, that this place which we value so much as psychoanalytic clinicians of being reflective and thoughtful, which I think is very important, but can it be used as a defense against the difficult questions of activity. So that's my sort of.
I think that's very interesting. I mean, I'm a political animal, as I know you are, and you use the term complacency. I've been concerned for quite a while now, but about kind of conformity of thinking, which might overlap with your complacency. I see it in like the corporate sector. I see it in the public sector when I'm working, and I see it particularly in coaching, consulting groups, that there's like repetitions and patterns of ways of thinking which are complacent.
I mean, I don't think it's you know, I think there are other terms that approach it. Conformity is one. I turning a blind eye. I mean, the whole range of things. Indifference. I suppose, you know, I'm trying to think about, you know, what's its attraction?
Yeah.
And, you know, what is the fear associated with activity? As if we can understand something about the internal world and the internal dynamics, but we can't really decide for ourselves what we think about the external world. And, you know, to some extent, complacency or conformity is a product of indecisiveness. Because, you know, if you are to take a stand in relation to the contemporary world, one has to take a slightly clumsy position sometimes.
Yeah.
Being in opposing something doesn't necessarily mean you know how to oppose it helpfully or where your opposition will lead. And I think this sense of not knowing where you're going can lead people to retreat into, well, I feel hopeless. You know, I can complain about the system. And there is an intoxication of complaint.
Yes.
But actually engaging with it, both in terms of how it may impinge upon one's clinical work or organizational work, but specifically as well about the institutions of which we are members, what do they feel able to comment on and engage with? And what's the price of not doing so?
Yeah.
You know, I don't want to spend too much time on Ukraine because I feel on very fragile ground. I'm just saying. I don't. When people limit their imagination and interrogation of reality, they settle for a position that could be seen as conformist or complacent.
Yeah.
That's really what I'm interested in.
I mean, part of complacency as well, I think, is a disassociation from what's happening, you know, and, you know, we'll move away from Ukraine, but there's an enjoyment. I mean, I've been reading a lot of Lacan recently and using Lacan's ideas as jouissance and enjoyment in my work a lot more, because I got, when working in organizations, I got stuck in looking just for the shadow side or the defenses, and actually realize how much kind of enjoyment there is, conscious and unconscious, the libido, the kind of energy in organizations, you know, the energy around someone like Trump, you know, what the pleasures of following Trump is actually when you're feeling disenfranchised and when you're feeling alienated from the mainstream and you don't have a voice, and you get this transgressive voice which speaks in a way which is different, then there's a pleasure and an enjoyment in that, isn't there?
Well, there's an immense enjoyment in destructiveness.
If you
I don't know whether you've seen the German edition of the All Quiet on the Western Front, you know, which is on Netflix at the moment and getting all these awards. It begins with a sort of celebration of going to war. I mean, the excitement.
Yeah.
Destructiveness. and the omnipotence in the belief that you'll hurt the other but never be hurt yourself, which of course the film brutally and brilliantly deconstructs, if you like.
What do you think in relationship to institutional life? You've been part of quite a famous institution, the Tavistock and Portman Clinic, for a good many years. And have you seen changes in the way institutions are thought about, embodied by their members? Do you have thoughts about that?
Well, yes, of course I do. and perhaps I should, the Tavistock has been a truly, an extraordinary place that developed many ideas, sent and trained clinicians and managers, who went all over the country. But I suppose one might think of it as that the TAVI flourished and produced really quite brilliant people. I mean, I could list many of them. But they existed in a rather protected environment. Not quite a university, although it was a place of learning as well as clinical practice. The trouble, I think, was the difficulty of recognizing that the marketplace, the chilly winds of the marketplace, were changing. Ever since, Thatcherism really was the beginning of it, and fairly consistently ever. So on the threat to the stance of the TAVI doesn't mean that it's any less relevant in terms of its ideas than it ever was. But its capacity to anticipate both the ambition and the ideology that was contained in the marketplace of mental health. And I think the difficulty with the TAVI, it's not in every place in the TAVI by any means, was how to treasure and promote what it does best, at the same time as recognizing and collaborating with a marketplace that is rapidly moving in another direction. That there have been all sorts of psychoanalytic modifications and applications since, and some of them are very useful. But I think the TAVI quite rightly thought that, that we were able to think about very, very distressed, unhappy, damaged, if you like, people. And then there needed to be a service that was able to contain them, treat them, and facing the reality that people don't just get better. Getting better is incredibly difficult for some people for all sorts of reasons. For others, which is why mindfulness or resilience or all the other sort of offers, CBT perhaps, for some people they're very helpful, there's no doubt. But if you make a split between, who can be helped by these shorter term work and those that we know carry on in deep distress, causing deep, deep distress to their families and their children and so forth. We have to keep a place in our mind that is not a psychiatric hospital, which, is needed for some patients, but a place which accepts that, some distress is so enduring that it needs a container. Now, I think the TAVI has struggled with this. I think the adult department did some wonderful work with very disturbed people and could again. But in a period of sort of where everything is dominated by sort of short-termism and community strategies, none of which I have any objection to, they all have their place, but not at the expense of the wisdom and experience of the tabi. So it's very difficult. And of course, you know, if you have a niche market and competitors come along, you have to respond to the competitors and find a way of protecting the niche. And it's very difficult.
Yeah.
But clever entrepreneurs do, you know. Burberry is a sort of case that everybody talks about, you know, a very niche market that managed to make itself popular as well as holding on to the niche.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't think any of this is easy.
No, I mean, it's interesting to think about the societal need. I was thinking when you talk about the tabi, I was also reminded of that the Henderson closed and some of these therapeutic communities closed other spaces which held this kind of longer term idea that, you know, that there's a space in society which is needed to contain dysfunction and long-term pain. And
but in the context of austerity, which has had an enormous impact, you know, yeah, on health services, you know, something corrosively competitive takes place, whereas clinicians working for the local mental health trust or wherever do look at the kind of privilege of the tabi enviously. And there's a sort of very unhealthy dynamic, rather than thinking that we have to find a way of being collegiate. Actually, it feels that if, you know, money is spent on longer term work at the tabi, it's at the expense of what they do. There's something of setting one clinical practice against another that creeps into the zeitgeist. And it's extraordinary how unpopular psychoanalysis has become in the public domain. As you say, the Henderson and all sorts of places, all sorts of psychoanalytics, yeah, have gone. And it's a tragedy for the service, I think. And the ease with which people have found a rationale for replacing them with all sorts of newly designated posts. The well-being officer, for example, or mental, yeah, advisors. I mean, all sorts of strange posts, you know, rather, yeah, than actually knowing that we need, you know, a breadth of clinical portfolios working together, seems to me.
Yeah, I mean, you've held positions of the British Psychoanalytic Council and Federation. You've been a psychoanalyst for a long time. What do you think about the position of psychoanalysis at the moment, and what possibilities there are for it to maybe regenerate, or what's your thoughts on it?
Well, I think it's going to be forced more and more into the private domain. It's going to be harder and harder for psychoanalytically driven therapeutic communities or practices, you know, to really have a sort of clear position. So I don't think psychoanalysis as such is under threat. I think the question is that what was learned in the applications of psychoanalysis at the TAVI, because it wasn't straightforwardly psychoanalytic, it applied psychoanalytic ideas faithfully, but not slavishly, mm-hmm, to the public domain and to the sorts of patients that were referred to by GPs. So I think there's a loss in two ways. If it just goes into the private sector, then of course their experience of the world is a product of who can pay for private treatment. That's yeah. one. And so that means that there's a problem for the institution about how it engages with modernity, such as it is, you know, how it thinks of itself responding to, you know, changing attitudes and views in society. The danger is that it becomes, you know, there's a sort of an admiration for its own thinking, which I do, I join them with, but at the expense of knowing that, you know, we only have a partial view. I suppose the other thing is that if there are no psychoanalytically informed trainings in the public sector, the people emerge from these psychoanalytic trainings with very little knowledge about opinions, about experience of the public domain. And then I think there's a loss to that, because I think that, you know, mental health as a social, ill health or distress as a social phenomenon is something that we should think about and think about how we contribute to it. So I think there's a danger there. You know, the laboratory of psychoanalysis will continue and it will produce some very clever, interesting people. I'm quite convinced, and it will attract equally intelligent and good people. I think the question is about the degree to which the institutions are sort of rather protected places. I mean, it's less so in some, maybe in Europe, it's not quite the same as in the States. I mean, the Holmes Commission, you know, has really embraced the question about racism and how it's penetrated the psychoanalytic thinking and protocols and trainings and so on. Well, there's been much less encouragement to do that here.
And I'm wondering then, where if you remove psychoanalysis from the public sector, from kind of a wider citizenship, what happens to the unconscious? How is it thought about or not thought about?
Well, I think it's always at risk of being denigrated as an idea. That there are internal forces at work in how we think about ourselves and how we respond. And they are as present in groups and organizations as they are in individuals. That the state of mind of an organization, I mean, you mentioned the capacity to play and have a libido, absolutely central. But, how in a more instrumentalized world is that being contained and crushed? You see, I think it's an openness. I mean, if you talk about the libido, you know, enjoyable sex requires imagination, and it requires, you know, some connection with the fantasies of both partners. You know, it's not all what to do or how to do it.
Yeah.
It involves internal feelings and ideas and that have to find an acceptable expression between whoever's involved. And so I think there is a real danger that a lot of instruments that will emerge, which will be allegedly about looking after people, well-being and so forth, but be rather punitive towards those people who can't make use of it for whatever reason.
Yeah.
I've always been very suspicious of the motivations behind gardening leave. an act seemingly of concern, but what it does is that it exports the particular staff member, you know, to a private place, and their distress or anxiety or whatever it is not understood as being related to the systemic reality that they worked in.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Very interesting, Julian. Do you have any other thing on your mind around psychoanalytic thinking in society, in politics, anything which is...
I think there is an interest in that domain. And, you know, there are all sorts of papers and conferences that... I suppose, I mean, it may be a function of, you know, my age and my experience. I don't think you can only have a psychoanalytic view of politics without the question about, you know, who do you make common cause with? Who are you willing to get into bed in activity with? Can you really develop a political view of the world if you're not involved in politics, with all the compromises and difficulties and, you know, maddening experience of it? So I think, you know, on the one hand, I think some wonderful ideas come out of these discourses and papers and conferences. But the core difficulty is those ideas traveling into the more messy area of politics, of activity. I've always found, although my view of it has changed a lot over the years, I've always found being a socialist helpful. So it gives me a sort of frame. Now, I sometimes to challenge the frame, and certainly the frame I had when I was a student is not the frame I have now. But somehow it sort of gives me a view of the world. I know it's incomplete. Mm-hmm. I know it's imperfect, but it allows me to do things and to connect to other people's struggles as a psychoanalyst, as a citizen, as somebody who's politically interested and active, that sometimes one has to just be an activist and not be a psychoanalyst.
Yeah.
Some issues require that. And so I think that's always the dilemma in the, you know, that, you know, psychoanalysis is our ideas for application and engagement. They're not just, you know, the joy of intellectual discourse. And there is joy in that. But from my point of view, I think, you know, trying to find ways of being active, I think, you know, where I try that, I often get teased for being the shrink in the room, because of course I talk about things that are influenced by, and the capacity of the group to tolerate that, I think, is not necessarily to do with my wisdom, but was to do with the fact that they know I'm going to be on the picket line or knocking on doors or whatever dreary activity, you know, is being politically active. So I don't think one has to go anonymously. On the other hand, one can't only go and interpret the group dynamics.
No.
Because they're pretty awful sometimes.
Indeed they are, as we know. Yeah, but I think, you know, that relationship has long been there, and long may it be. And like you say, it's always partial. It's interesting, the Lacanians in France are kind of struggling with this question at the moment about how political to be. And it's very interesting to see it play out. But
I sometimes think, where are the youthful politics? I suppose I grew up in a period in the late 60s and 70s where there was an enormous amount of political activity in the young, which has formed the views of a whole generation of, social policy and so on and so on. And I do sometimes wonder where the political expression of the young is. And that was what was so attractive about Corbyn. Everybody's, he's so easy to denigrate, but he was able to inspire young people. Mm-hmm. Rather than, what's happened since is, they've all left. And I think that's a tragedy, because we need, politics needs youth, it needs energy, it needs libido, it needs challenge.
I mean, at the moment it seems to be channeled predominantly into the environmental movement. That's where I see the predominant activity of a new generation.
Yes, and identity politics, yes.
Yeah, strongly identity politics. Yeah, I'm in the middle of a group relations conference now, and I work in the States in particular. The identity politics are phenomenally strong. Very, very interesting. Julian, it's been really lovely talking to you. We're coming to the end of the podcast. I ask guests at the end two questions: what it means to live a good life, and what it means to create a good society. From your lived experience, very complex questions, but any thoughts on what it means to live a good life and to create a good society?
Well, nice, simple questions to end up with.
Of course.
Good life, being able to love someone and to use that experience to inform kindness towards others. I'm a great believer in kindness. A good society can't be such an idea given the gross inequality at all sorts of levels that we have. I don't know the answer to the second question. I was about to say, ask the question, can you really have a good society under capitalism?
Good question. No, I think it's a strong. My query is really around striving towards something,
I suppose striving to a recovery of the idea that. The public sector is an expression of a society that we care about. You see, once you make the, once you call the public sector the nanny state, mm-hmm. as Thatcher did so famously, and it caught on, so the question is, where's the mother gone? Where's the mother gone? Where's the maternal state? And I think, in a sense, the public sector strikes at the moment are trying to reassert the idea of a maternal state, which has, it's housing, education, law, roads, libraries, and so on. And if you lose that, as we are at risk of with privatization, we're not moving towards a better society, in my view, but a more atomized one.
That's very helpful, Julian. Thank you very much. It's been lovely talking with you again. Take care.
Here you go. Bye.